Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. And it is Monday. That means it's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke because it's a jokey time coming up a little bit later on. We are going to talk about some of the biggest pop culture disappointments of all time. And we are also going to talk about some gadgets from the 80s that were ridiculous, like many things in the 80s. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, on Facebook.com/Nick D Show as well. Okay, a little change here in the lineup. Our Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress is with us. Colin Suter dropped out at the beginning of the year to pursue some other stuff and go back to school. And then we lost Jim Leskowski last week. So coming in to save the day is our good friend Steve Procopi, who has been on the show several times, and he has been kind enough to step in and be a permanent member of the movie review squad here on Monday mornings. So first of all, let's welcome Eric. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, making his debut. Steve Procopi, how you doing, Steve?
I'll hold for applause while everyone calms down. Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is very exciting. I appreciate you stepping in, man. I really
do. Of course. Of course. I'm happy to do it.
Give everybody a little background where you write and what you work and all that cool stuff so people get to know you.
Currently, film reviews can be found at Third Coast Review. Some interviews that I do can also be found there, as well as places like Slash Film, just various freelancing outlets. And then I'm also just, like 3 months ago, started as the public relations manager at the Music Box Theater, and now I'm doing this. So.
Yeah.
Because I don't have enough to do. So.
All right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, congratulations on the gig at the Music Box, man.
Yeah.
I know how much that place means to all of us. So
sure, yeah.
Very, very cool. All right, we got a ton of stuff to talk about this week, so we should just dive right in. Why don't we start off? I mean, it's not in movie theaters, but it was, like, for me, one of the events of the weekend was Deadwood, the movie. Eric, why don't you tell us about Deadwood, the movie? We'll give that a review for people who want to watch it on HBO.
Right. Well, Deadwood, the series, many people know, had three seasons on HBO back in the early 2000s, and had a kind of abrupt surprise cancellation, much to the dismay of not just its cast, but its legions of viewers.
Yeah.
But you know, we were told at the time that David Milch was actually going to be given the opportunity to sort of write a couple of follow-up movies to basically sort of close out the remaining storylines and whatnot, but that didn't happen. They dismantled all the sets. Everyone went their separate ways, and somehow, miraculously, you know, more than a decade later, we have been given an opportunity to have this conclusion to Deadwood, which is just basically what it is. David Milch wrote the screenplay for it, and it takes place, I think it's like 10 years or
yeah,
something like that after
yeah,
the events where we last left the series. South Dakota is being admitted into the Union, and so a number of people from the town who were once prospered there or lived there are actually returning as part of a celebration. There's so many characters to go through.
Yeah.
We don't want to, can't give away what's going on with everyone, but Timothy Oliphant is back as Bullock. The great Ian McShane is back as Al Swearengen. And time seems to have sort of taken its toll on Al. His health is very much waning, and he's kind of a symbol of not just what the town is sort of becoming now that the America is sort of moving on with the future, but also, you know, kind of a surrogate for Milch himself, who's actually been diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
It's sort of this kind of a really kind of bittersweet kind of send-off that we have going with Swearengen. Not that he's not his usual ornery self, for certain, but it's all part of this storyline that involves bringing back Hearst, Senator Hearst, played by Gerald McCraney, who is sort of the de facto villain of the third and final season, and how the sort of the events that transpired at the end of that season are all sort of coming back and folding onto one another. It involves cover-ups and murder and attempted murders and stuff, while everyone is basically going to try to survive this final showing. So I mean, you know, like I said, this is kind of a bit of a miracle that we even got this thing. Is this exactly how we wanted everything to, how we would have imagined everything would have concluded after the final season? Maybe not necessarily, but unlike what some people have disappointments with series that do have a regular succession and then go on. I could mention Game of Thrones for some people, not myself, but people are really disappointed in that finale. I don't see how they can be dissatisfied with what transpires here. This is a really terrific send-off to the show and to these characters. It's rich with a lot of the themes and the ideas that really perpetrated through that show for the three seasons. The dialogue is as rich as ever. The characters, it's just so great to be in the presence of all these people again, and to see many of them get a proper goodbye in many ways, that is just really quite satisfying. And that's the word that I kept saying to myself watching this the premiere Friday night, is that it is just so entirely satisfying. There are so many things about it that just made me just want to leap out of my chair in enjoyment. I watched it like 2.5 times this weekend, just rewatching certain scenes, and there's so many wonderful moments, and the performances are great, and it just it's so wonderful. I mean, I can't get past that part of it, that is just so uniquely satisfying to have an end to the show, and I think it ends it on a really kind of perfect note, but with a lot of finality. There's a lot of things that happen in this episode that bring closure to a number of things, and I keep saying the word, do so in an immensely satisfying way.
Yeah. Okay. Steve, what about you, man?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. One of the things I thought maybe benefited the show getting cut off the way it was that the temptation a lot of times when a show like this enters a final season is to kill off characters, but they didn't get a chance to do that, so there's so many people to bring back.
Yeah.
And there's so many people to wonder about. Like, another mark of a great show or a great movie is that years later, your mind kind of sweeps over that show and wonders where those people ended up. And this is like one of those very rare opportunities where we get to see that. And it is immensely satisfying. Every so often I just stop and go, I can't believe I'm watching
yeah.
this. I can't believe this is on. Let me just call out a couple quick people. I mean, specific performances. This has got to be Robin Weigert's Emmy nomination. Like she's
unbelievable. She's unbelievable.
She was always good in it, but there's something about the way that her character arc goes in this movie that is so deeply wonderful. And not everyone gets that kind of moment in this because there's just too many characters. But certainly the character of Charlie Utter has a really important role to play here. Obviously, Ian McShane is always good, but he's also probably the most sympathetic he's ever been. Oliphant is great. I completely forgot some actors that were in this show, to be honest. I was also really, it wasn't just last year that we saw Brad Dourif, was it a flashback weekend?
Yeah, he was a flashback with the weird facial hair.
That's the first time it really hit me that this was happening.
Because
I heard him say to his daughter in the elevator, he couldn't, she said, to shave your mustache. And he's like, I can't, because of Deadwood.
Because of Deadwood, yeah.
Because he was literally going from flashback being to Deadwood. And I love the way that the very minimal way they use flashbacks in this, just to remind us of everything. It's not like a huge flashback thing at all, but just enough to remind us where these people stand with each other or with the town. The language, Eric mentioned the language. It's even denser and, like, you can't improvise on a show like this. It's like half Shakespeare, half Mamet. It's just like, it's every word means something, is specific, and you can't change it, and you wouldn't want to change it, but you might have to put on the closed captioning because it's so dense and so wonderful. Yeah, and then, of course, like I was also really impressed with Molly Parker in this, who was my absolute favorite Canadian, period. I think she's great in everything, and I was so happy to see her come back in this. And I deliberately didn't look to see ahead of time who was coming back and who wasn't, and was really pleasantly surprised to see that pretty much everyone came back, including people I thought were dead. I was surprised that Garrett Dillahunt wasn't back in this as like a third new character.
Yeah.
So, But anyway, yeah, it really does have a finality, but it also, I mean, I don't think they're going to make another one, but there is still that room in my head now where I can think, okay, so I'm going to think about these guys again for the next 20 years and like wonder what's going on with them, because things are left open-ended too. So, they resist the temptation to just kill a bunch of people. It really worked. And I was surprised because I was nervous about this one. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to ruin like a perfect run like this show had, but yeah. This is a perfect capper.
Yeah. Okay, guys, hang on. Okay, I'll tell you what I thought of it. We got to take a break. Steve Procopi is with us now. He's our new reviewer. Eric Childress are here, and we're talking about Deadwood the movie. It's a movie, but it's not in theaters. But we had to talk about Deadwood. I mean, you could not. So we're gonna take a break. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Deadwood the movie, and then we got a ton of other stuff to talk about too. Right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are back, and we're live here in the Allstate Skyline Studio till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and our new buddy here, Steve Procopi, who has now joined the team here, will be part of the Monday morning movie reviews. Before the break, Eric and Steve told you what they thought of Deadwood, the movie, and I think I just lost Steve. Can we get Steve back on the line? That's a nice debut. I cut the guy off on his first morning. Well, anyway, you know, we'll get Steve back on. Let me just say, I echo everything you guys said about Deadwood. I thought it was phenomenal. And I was really looking forward to it, and I loved the show. And it was everything that I had hoped it would be. And then even more, I think, you know, getting to see these characters again, being back in that place, listening to that incredible dialogue and watching these actors just go at it again. And it just it brought back everything that I loved about the show while I was watching it. It was incredible. There are a couple of few things that I do want to mention. Here's Steve.
Hi. Sorry.
Hey, welcome back. Sorry about that. Well, welcome to the show, Steve, by cutting you off.
Wow, technical difficulties on the first day.
Exactly. Right. Well, we're back. I was just saying to Eric, Steve, that I echo everything you guys said about Deadwood. It was absolutely great. And again, you know, we've used the word now 50 times, satisfying, but that's exactly what it was. And it was just a real joy to get back into that world. And, you know, as you guys mentioned, the language is even deeper and more significant. I got to say that I did not expect to be as emotionally wrecked as I was by it. And I think that there's a real heft to it because of what's going on with Milch in real life. I mean, it really added a lot, you know, a lot of emotion to while watching the movie. And I didn't expect to get teary-eyed, but I did. And on top of that, I mean, just watching all these guys do their thing and Robin Weichert, man, I'm telling you, everybody's unbelievable, but she's the standout for me. And that emotional ride that we went on throughout the series was there. And I think, you know, tenfold. It was hard to see all these people come back and not have Powers Booth there. That was a little bit, you know. That was a little something, you know, because he was such a great part of the show, you know, originally. Mm-hmm. And so he was definitely missed. But this is a triumph as far as I'm concerned. It's an absolute triumph. And it ended this, it was incredible because it was so, I was one of those people like you guys who was so pissed off when they canceled it.
Yeah.
I was so angry. I was like, well, how, what? What? And then we have to wait all this time, but we finally get the payoff here. This is a huge, huge payoff. And I'll tell you something, man. Friday night, 7 o'clock, I was right there.
Yeah.
I was right there, man. I did not DVR it. I did not wait. 7 o'clock, I was on the couch in front of my TV watching the Deadwood movie, and I loved every second of it. So,
well, no Powers Booth, but we did get Jeffrey Jones back.
Yes,
so.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
Yeah, that was.
I was not expecting it.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. So great stuff. Great stuff all the way around. Yeah. So Deadwood, the movie, it'll be, you know, repeated 900 times on HBO.
Yep.
It's available on HBO Go. So I, you know, if you're a fan of the show, you got to see, well, you probably watched it. That would be my guess. If you're a fan of the show, you probably watched it. So, all right. Let's see. Hey, Steve, why don't you tell us about Domino?
Really? Okay. Have you ever wondered what it's like to have a really talented director not care about his plot or characters? Let's talk about Domino a little bit. Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who plays Christian, a Copenhagen detective, who he and his partner go to a domestic disturbance call, and they find out that it might actually be a murder when they confront a suspect in the elevator, and Christian has forgotten his gun, so he has to borrow his partner's gun, even though his partner is guarding the prisoner. While he goes to the scene, they haven't even been to the scene of the crime yet, and they go there, and of course the prisoner not only escapes, but stabs the partner in the throat, and he ends up dying, so basically the film then turns into, I will give the film credit, the bad guys in this movie are ISIS. They're not some like random terrorist group that doesn't actually exist in the world.
Yeah.
It's ISIS.
Yeah.
And I feel like that takes a little bit of guts to just name it like that.
Yeah.
But I'll give it credit there. But it turns out that this guy who stabs his partner isn't exactly the criminal they think he is. He did commit the murder, but he's also in a way being forced to by ISIS, and it becomes a pursuit across multiple countries. Carice Van Houten, again, also from Game of Thrones, like Nikolai is, it becomes his new partner, and she, it turns out, has a bit of a connection to his dead partner that is not that hard to figure out, even though they hold off telling us what it is for a while. Guy Pearce is here as a CIA agent who is trying to keep this escaped criminal from the Danish police for his own selfish reasons, because he'd be a great informant against ISIS. And there's a little bit of a cat and mouse game here, but man, it feels like someone who grew up loving Brian De Palma films aping Brian De Palma. It does not feel like it's the master making his best work, and it just felt like he was going through the motions. He's reusing tricks, visual tricks that we've seen him do, the split screens, the sort of steady cam through crowded venues. We've seen this all before. I don't even think the acting is very good in it. And these are very, Guy Pearce is kind of funny in it, but everybody else just likes, they are not being guided through this story the way they need to be. It's a very short film, which I'm guessing wasn't always the case, because it feels very choppy and rushed, and there's not a lot of time for just getting to know these people, and therefore I didn't really like them very much, which you don't have to like characters to like the movie, but I think in this film it might have helped a little bit. The surprises aren't that surprising, and the tension isn't that tense, and I kind of just hated it. So that's about all I got to say.
Well, here's the thing. I hated it too, Steve, and I'm one of the biggest Brian De Palma fans.
Yeah.
And apologists. Listen, I think Raising Kane's a masterpiece. That's how much I like Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
So this is two in a row for him that I think are unwatchable. This his last one, what the hell was it called? Passion?
Passion.
Yeah. Awful. Absolutely awful, and going through the motions, and this is just, I mean, this barely qualifies as a movie. It's so bad, and you know, about half an hour into it, I was like, what the hell happened to Brian De Palma, you know? And I mean, he doesn't make many movies. You know, his last really great movie, I thought, was Redacted, And I thought that was a terrific movie, but he made that one already when he made Casualties of War. It's basically the same movie. So, but this is just like, I mean, it's like, okay, I guess I should do split screen here. I guess I should do a slick camera move here. You know, there's a set piece on a rooftop at the beginning of the movie that feels, like you said, Steve, like somebody trying to do De Palma. And it just was, it is a terrible movie, and it's not shocking that it went straight to video. It's not shocking that it's 88 minutes long. It's just shocking that Brian De Palma's got his name on it. That's about it. It's a terrible movie, and it pains me to say that about one of my favorite filmmakers on the planet, but man, it was bad.
You know, I mean, there are certain directors like De Palma and a few others that I won't name that you kind of want to put out the pasture a little bit, that it seems like they're past their prime, that they're not, you know, they're doing stuff by rote kind of thing, you know, but even you think of like guys like even like Sidney Lumet, for example, like you know, had did a lot of, you know, rote stuff for years, and then before The Devil Knows You're Dead, they're like, oh my God,
yeah,
you know, he's back. You know, so you keep hoping that, you know, I'm watching Domino, just like, maybe this is going to be it. This is going to be his comeback. This is going to be the one. And after that rooftop sequence, I would have settled for 88 minutes of tricks.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it seems like this is what you enjoy doing, Brian.
Yeah.
Just do it the entire movie, because you don't care about the characters. You don't care about the plot. I certainly don't care about whose affair the partner is having with the former partner. Like, what was that?
I don't know.
What the hell was that? That's the character motivation, and that leads to, I don't want to go too far, but I'm just like really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's absurd. It is an absurd movie. And you know, and like you said, Steve, the only person that seems to be providing any energy at all is Guy Pearce, and he's bad in it.
Yeah.
You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, at least he's energetic, but he's not good in the movie. I mean, I think he read the script and went, oh, man, does this suck? So I'm just gonna ham it up as much as possible. Yeah, this is a disaster, and I just it pains me to say that because I love Brian De Palma. But okay.
If I'm not mistaken, he's not particularly happy with it either.
Well, he shouldn't be.
I think I've heard that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if somebody took it away from him or what, but at this point,
yeah,
they should just take the cameras away from him.
I agree. Mm. All right, you guys, hang on, okay?
Yep.
All right. Steve Procopi, Eric Childress. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio on a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the biggest pop culture disappointments, and we're going to talk about weird gadgets from the 80s and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Right now, though, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me here to do the movie reviews. Let's get back to it. Steve, you're there. Oh, I didn't hang up on you. Okay.
I'm here.
All right. And Eric is here as well. Welcome back.
Yes.
All right, Eric, I didn't get a chance to see this when you guys did. I was very curious about it. tell us, Eric, about Ma.
Oh, okay. Well, this is the latest from Blumhouse Productions and director Tate Taylor, their first collaboration, I believe. But the film stars Octavia Spencer as a woman who works at a veterinarian's office or kill shelters. I don't remember if it was actually clear. I think it's a vet office. It is a vet office, yeah. And one day she is approached by a group of teenagers to buy them alcohol. She's a little reticent at first, but does agree to buy them all the alcohol they want. And in fact, even eventually gives them a place to consume the alcohol in the basement of her house. And soon it becomes a thing. The new girl in town, played by Diana Silvers, who's also in Booksmart, currently in theaters, her and her mom, Juliette Lewis, have just moved to town, and she's making new friends, so she becomes part of this little clique that becomes involved in having parties in Octavia Spencer's basement. But some cracks in the armor begin to show. Octavia's character, who she says to call her Ma, might have ulterior motives in what she's doing with these kids. It seems very clear that not necessarily that she's out of balance, per se, but that she's definitely got something up her sleeve that is kind of dispersed throughout the film. We kind of get an idea bit by bit exactly where she's kind of going with this plot. And that's about all we really want to say about the plot in general. This is a film that it reminded me of the kind of like exploitation films from the 60s and 70s that were very low budget and kind of had something to say, were not fully fleshed out to say something of great importance, but the fact that they were saying anything in kind of a cheap exploitation piece of trash kind of up the stakes a little bit, kind of gave it a little bit of nuance and gravitas that people sort of remember those films for. I don't think many people are going to be remembering this film in particular, because I think that, for one, Tate Taylor is not a good filmmaker. This is the guy that did The Help, Get On Up, the James Brown biopic, and The Girl on the Train. And here, he's got so much meat on the bone to be playing with here as far as themes are concerned, and what's going on with Octavia Spencer's character, and through the flashbacks, and sort of instead of treating this like a mystery and that everything's going to be revealed in the end, he keeps flashing back to what really occurred with her, and so there is a bit of a sympathetic view that we have towards this character, even though we suspect it's sort of leading to a sort of, a really, kind of gross payoff in a way. But it seems like at every opportunity, this movie just seems to pull its punches, and so by the time it gets to its final act, it doesn't have the kind of impact. In fact, it doesn't even really go far enough as far as kind of cheap thrills are concerned, and I think that's kind of a disappointment, with the exception of sort of one hilarious moment involving Octavia driving her van. I don't think anything else that comes after it even comes close to matching that. And like I said, just like Tate Taylor, I saw this interview that he did, and someone asked him about the idea about what Octavia Spencer's character is going through as far as in relations to race, considering that the trauma that this character has gone through is always has been at the hands of kind of privileged white teenagers, and Tate Taylor just completely dismisses it out of hand, as if there's nothing to that.
He did direct The Help, Eric.
I said, and this is a guy, he directed Get On Up, so yeah. Clearly this guy knows how to pull his punches.
Yeah.
He avoids them, is what I'm saying. Anyway, and so it's just like, so I kind of sat there just like, what was everything leading up to? Why would you take these certain routes that sort of miss the point of everything you're going for? Because it's all right there. It's all just sitting out there waiting to be plucked. And then when it just kind of avoids all that, it doesn't even deliver on the finale that you're expecting or that you really kind of want at that point in some sort of satisfying way. While Octavia Spencer's good, she's always good. I really like her a lot in just about anything, particularly in a movie called Loose that's going to be opening later this year. I just think that this movie is a real missed opportunity, and I was really disappointed with it.
Okay. All right, Steve, what do you think?
Basically the same. The real question is what is Octavia Spencer doing in this? Because she's not clearly, and she's a producer on this film too, and she's not afraid to punch instead of pulling punches when it comes to dealing with race in films. Why would she make this film? And I almost wonder, especially the scenes where we see her as a teenager in high school, she seems to be like the only black kid in the school, or one of the only ones at least, and you kind of wonder if that's the motivation for all of the things that she goes through. Then why not deal with it head on? It feels like a series of missed opportunities in this film. And she is good, but at the same time, this isn't an Octavia Spencer performance like anything we've seen. And I mean that she doesn't really seem to be giving it her all. I don't think she was embarrassed by it, but she should be, and she probably will become embarrassed by it as time goes on. But it's a real baffling film that, like, nothing. There's nothing sort of endearing about any of this, or like none of the characters really struck me as being particularly. Like, I didn't care about any of these teenagers. Like, there's nothing about these teenagers that would make me think this woman would want to be, would allow them to even come into her home. And even when we realize why she is, I kind of wonder why she's taking so much of it out on the kids and not more the parents, who is the one she has the real issues with. It's a confusing and kind of ugly film that I will never think about again.
Okay. All right. There you go. All right, that's Ma, and not recommended by Steve or Eric. Steve, why don't you tell us about The Tomorrow Man?
Okay, here's another disappointment with some great actors in it. This is the feature debut from a writer-director named Noble Jones, who had made some short films and music videos that were pretty popular. It's less a film about two older people finding each other than... and those two older people are John Lithgow and Blythe Danner, who have been in millions of good films. And it's more about it's more of an acting exercise from these two wonderful performers who really aren't doing their best work in this sort of quirky, not especially interesting look at the way people view the immediate future. Lithgow plays a guy who was a former systems analyst at a factory, and he's a man of numbers and data and planning. And the thing he's planning for in his older age is this sort of vague idea that the world is going to come to some sort of global crisis. And he wants to be ready for it, and he probably won't happen in his lifetime, but he still wants to be ready for it. And it's a bit of a mystery for a while how he's getting ready for it, but we find out pretty soon. And then sort of during one of his trip to the grocery store, he spots this woman who Blythe Danner plays, and he's intrigued enough by her that he sort of arranges to meet her in the parking lot, and pretty soon they're dating. And it's sweet and kind of funny because she's more laid back and doesn't think about the future and thinks too much about the past. And that has some weird implications about her, the way she lives her life, which is more of a mystery in this film. But the reveals aren't that interesting, I don't think. And I don't know. I guess I didn't. I was more worried that these people needed to be in therapy than with each other. So I kind of lost interest pretty early. They're not bad. Certainly the performances are not bad. It's more the writing, I think, that suffers. The directing's fine, too. It's actually a beautiful film to look at. But the writing is probably the problem. But I don't think the messages that Noble Jones is trying to get through to us here are really hitting it on the head. And then there's a whole family drama with Lithgow's family that doesn't really amount to much. So it's a bit of a wasted opportunity. Not a terrible film, but certainly skippable.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Steve Procopi, Eric Childress are reviewing the new movies. We've got a few more to review here, right here on 720 WGN. We'll do it right after the break.
Boulevard. Some that you recognize,
everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive on this Monday morning. And because it is Monday, that means it's movie review times. Eric Childress and our new critic here with us, Steve Procopi. We've seen a bunch of movies. We got more to review. And let's welcome Steve back. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Eric, tell us about The Perfection.
Okay, I'll give it a shot.
Better you than me.
We don't want to say too much about this movie.
Oh, yeah,
but,
it's true. Yeah.
The setup of the movie is that Allison Williams plays sort of a former cellist, a very talented cellist who at a young age had to drop out of a very prestigious Boston music school because her mother was terminally ill, though she sort of hung on for a while. While she was nursing her, basically lost all her opportunities within the music world. But after she passes, she does come back to the music school that is run by Steven Weber. They are sort of admitting this new student played by Logan Browning. She's now the star pupil. The two of them, Allison Logan's character, female, form a relationship and go on a little excursion together while some illness might be happening around the area at the time. That's all I'm going to say about this plot. Because one of the joys of this really sort of beautifully structured and directed horror film is in the discovery. It's a film that is actually divided into the three parts. It's three acts, or almost like three different movies in many ways, although they do form a cohesive whole. Watching this movie and not really knowing what it was about, other than Allison Williams played a cellist, is the right way to go into this film. And it's a film that, strikingly very early on, it's rare with a horror film these days that I get very unsettled.
Yeah.
And there is a scene early in the film that takes place on a bus.
Yep.
And anyone who's had stomach problems can relate to what goes on that bus. And it was very uncomfortable to watch. What then occurs afterwards is equally troubling. And then the movie takes a different direction from there, but leading to, again, some very satisfactory comeuppances throughout the film. This is a film is sort of kind of very, very much of the time. It's very perfect for culturally things that are going on as far as, I guess you could say, female empowerment in a way, but certainly also instances of Me Too and toxic masculinity and organizations that use their power for really horrible things. Like I said, just go into this movie. You'll come out of it, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe in a good way. You are forewarned about it, because it is very unlike most of the horror movies you're seeing these days. But it owes itself a lot to a lot of really classic stuff. Cronenberg, for example. I left this movie what I think is a perfect final shot.
Mm-hmm.
I love the final shot of this movie. I can't recommend this movie highly enough.
Yes.
Which played at our Chicago Critics Film Festival too.
Right. And it's on Netflix. That you can see it, now on Netflix. Steve, what did you think?
Nick, you probably maybe have a similar reaction, especially with horror films. I grew up watching them. I still watch probably more horror films in a year than any other kind of film. If a horror film can surprise me,
yeah,
I give it points and will more than likely recommend it just because that doesn't happen very often. And this film, the whole ending especially, but not just the ending, really took me by surprise. And some people might find this film unwatchable, but they won't find it unforgettable. I should mention the director, Richard Shepard, who did stuff like The Matador and The Hunting Party. I did like a dozen episodes of Girls, which probably explains the Allison Williams connection. But and he also, I think, just did one of these new Twilight Zones for Jordan Peele. So, but man, it has sort of a Black Swan vibe to it at times because the two girls do form a very close relationship. There's a great duet where they're playing their cellos together that is shot like a sex scene, and it's really cool. And again, never seen anything like that before. So bring it. That film at one point, I think we can say this sort of doubles back on itself.
Right.
And shows us some things around that bus sequence twice, that's not really exactly right, and that's fine. You don't need to know exactly what it is. But it just opens up the film in an entirely different way at a certain point. And, as Eric said, the less you know about this going in, the better. And to the people that at our Critics Fest that love this movie, they love this movie.
Yeah.
And I think the ones that didn't were not quite sure what to think.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And this is, I think we've comfortably warned people that this is a movie that's not for everybody. I thought it was great. And like you, Steve, it surprised me. And again, just like you, I see 9,000 horror movies a month. And, and this one was genuinely surprising and really got under my skin. No pun intended. But it really it worked, man. It really worked. I thought about this movie for a lot when it was over. I just kind of sat there going, wow. And I think we have to make sure that Allison Williams starts making movies where black people should not be suspicious of her. I think that's a pattern that might be happening here. This is great stuff. I mean, if you're a horror fan, this is the deal, and it doesn't hold back. It goes for it on every level, and Steven Weber's hilarious in it. I just wanted to mention it. I love Steven Weber in the movie. I really did. He was so having a blast and having so much fun. And again, beautifully directed movie. Like really, really beautifully directed. So I highly recommend it. This is for horror fans only, though. And this is this is a movie that being a horror fan, even I went ooh during a lot of it. But I thought it was great. So it's on Netflix and it's called The Perfection. All right, cool. Okay, let's see. Steve, why don't you tell us about... Eric, you didn't see Rocket Man?
No, I did.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, good. Steve, tell us about Rocket Man.
The more I thought about this film since I saw it, the more I really liked what it did. I, it's funny, I've already spotted think pieces about... this is Elton John biopic in quotes, and breaking down almost scene by scene, figuring out which scenes are truthful and which aren't. I'm like, wow, in a movie that labels itself a musical fantasy, the concept of truth is more of a recommendation than a requirement. So I'm not really sure that really matters as much as some people think it should.
Well,
in this,
Steve, here's the thing.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to do with, the reaction that Bohemian Rhapsody.
Of course. I get it.
I mean, I despised Bohemian Rhapsody. I thought it was awful and completely inaccurate. But this movie, and we'll talk about this, we're going to have to break here. This movie is a fantasy. It's a musical. It's a fantasy. Mm-hmm. So people who are taking umbrage about how, that it's inaccurate. What the hell? I mean, what?
I know.
I mean, I don't understand. I mean, at one point he's playing the piano, he floats in the air. Is that an inaccuracy? No.
I bet you to the people there it was not an inaccuracy,
right,
though. And I
right.
bet you they all thought they were floating just like they are in the movie.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Hang on, Steve, because we got to take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk more about Rocket Man, which is the film about Elton John. And we'll talk more about it coming up right after. And also, it doesn't help that the guy who shadow directed Bohemian Rhapsody actually directed this. So that makes the comparisons even more. All right, we'll take a break and come back, talk about Rocket Man after this. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. On a Monday morning, that means my dad's going to tell a joke. It's also Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. And with Steve Procopi and Eric Childress. And let's get Steve back. Steve, welcome
back.
Hello.
Yes.
Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve, continue to tell us about Rocket Man.
So, as I was saying before, it's not a straight fact, you know, like scene-by-scene factual biopic, but they do hit a lot of key moments in his life from when he was a child to, I think this goes up to about the mid-80s when he finally goes into rehab and takes the rehab seriously. What it does, remarkably so, is it uses the lyrics to his songs, and I should mention Taron Egerton plays and sings Elton John's music, and he's amazing, both as a performer and a singer, who knew, the lyrics that Bernie Taupin wrote, which, you know, they knew each other very well, so he could write to a degree about Elton's struggles and his pain and from his childhood and just feeling unloved for a big part of his life, but they used the lyrics as the storytelling device. And this is a full-on musical, and I don't want to, everyone should know, they've done kind of a weird job of hiding that in a lot of the trailers, but this is a musical. People are breaking out into song in the middle of moments you would not expect it. It's not just like an on-stage kind of musical or recording studio musical. It is everywhere, and the songs aren't necessarily even from the era they're portraying, which I found fascinating and kind of gutsy. But, man, I mean, I was not fully aware of Elton John's childhood. He had a rough life. His father left him, his family, when he was young, and the mother, who Bryce Dallas Howard plays, he was left with, wasn't a gem either. From the way the movie portrays her, at least. The framework of the film is an AA meeting that he's in full costume for, because he's just walked off stage in his AA meeting, and he just sort of tells his story to these strangers. I got to give Jamie Bell a ton of credit for playing Bernie Taupin. He's also remarkably good, and as we already know, can sing really well. I also want to call out Richard Madden, who used to be on Game of Thrones, to play Elton John's first manager, John Reed, and I guess first male lover, who was a bit of a snake and a seducer and milked a guy for a lot of money and worked him to the bone and didn't care that he was turning into a substance abuser. I could almost make a case for Richard Madden to play James Bond, though, after seeing him in this role. It's this sort of got these fantastical edges to it, and it's in this realm of magical realism. And if there's ever a life story to be told with magical realism, it's Elton John's. And the costumes are all there, and the glasses, and there are some great performance moments. But man, it just kind of wants to be the total package. And for a large part, it is. And they aren't just using songs that you know, but they're using a lot of songs that you know. I think they're just using the best songs for that moment. And you mentioned Dexter Fletcher is the one who directed this. He and Edgerton made what I think is an underrated film called Eddie the Eagle a couple years ago together, and they clearly have a great relationship. And yeah, it was a little nerve. It made me a little nervous that this is the guy that wrapped up Bohemian Rhapsody, but I think we know where a large part of the flaw in that film lies.
Yeah.
Not with him. So, but man, I just enjoyed the hell out of this thing. I wasn't sure if I would going in.
Yeah, okay. All right. What about you, Eric?
Well, first, I think it's kind of interesting that apparently we're going to have nothing but Game of Thrones actors playing John Reed until the end of time, considering that Aidan Gillen played him in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Right.
So that's kind of funny. But not to, you know, belabor the point in Bohemian Rhapsody, but, you know, I mean, we are sort of in close proximity to that Oscar-winning movie. And like you, Nick, I just despise the hell out of that movie.
Yeah.
But not only Queen was not the only music that I really got into as a kid, but there was a lot of Elton John in my house at the time too. I heard a lot of his music first on like compilation albums, actually, and then that led to discovering his music elsewhere. But the Bohemian Rhapsody thing, one of the things that I thought that where that movie could have improved, considering that it was just going to take a, you know, a giant, you know, on history, that they might as well, since it was just going to be about the music and people are just going to walk away going like, damn, that was really good music, that it should have just been the rock opera, maybe not the one they made that everyone thinks isn't particularly good, but you just craft a whole new rock opera around it. And this feels like they took that advice that was out there. Dexter Fletcher maybe saw what transpired after Bohemian Rhapsody and said, like, you know what, we're going to go this route with this movie. And I think it's the right choice. And I was very skeptical very early on in this movie, the minute he walked into that AA meeting. I was just like, oh, it seems like they're like we're already starting with the walk hard cliches in a way that he's gonna tell you all about his life before, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I think that some of the transitions into musical are a little awkward sometimes. It just seems like someone just goes, okay, now, instead of there being kind of a build-up to the moment. So for about halfway through this movie, I was sort of kind of going back and forth, liking the musical numbers individually, the drama, maybe not quite so much. But as the film just kept developing, and I was sort of drawn more and more into Edgerton's performance, who I think is magnificent in this movie. I think Edgerton, you know, does stuff as Elton John. And, you know, Rami Malek, every time I was watching him as Freddie Mercury, I felt him acting. Like, I saw him acting with his teeth. I saw him doing that. And then the way that they, Edgerton and Fletcher, they put sort of give their own spin on the songs themselves, not just commenting on the action, but giving you, you know, not the classic recordings that we're all used to. So putting them in, you know, spinning them like a musical, I thought was a really smart choice as well. I think Jamie Bell is also very good, that these two performances kind of carry the movie. And I wish there was, Steve sort of mentioned the sort of you know, Taupin being there at these key moments in Elton's life, you know, though a lot of the stuff, you know, was written before he knew Elton, and at least in the beginning of the story. And I wish there was more of those moments like the Your Song moment. Yeah. Those are the moments in these sort of stories that I really get into, the discovery of the music, the creation of it. And I think that's one of the best scenes in the movie. And I wish there was a bit more of that. But bringing this thing sort of full circle and watching Edgerton's full immersion into Elton John, again, I think is just magnificent in this movie. And then getting up to the point where the movie, you know, catches up with itself and gets into the rehab scene, there's more power to it. Because, you know, because it wasn't just like, hi, I'm Elton John, and I'm wearing a flamboyant costume, and I'm walking an AA meeting, and that's how we're going to start this movie because, you know, you all know who Elton John is. No, there's real power to that moment later on in the film. And I found myself kind of unexpectedly emotional by the end of the story. You know, I bought this sort of turnaround and ending on that one song. I thought it was a little odd that they ended with the music video of that particular song. But well, it's actually one of my favorite Elton songs from the 1980s.
It was a recreation of the video. It wasn't
It's not a recreation. They just put Karen Edgerton over Elton John.
Oh, they just put him over
Elton
John?
It's the exact video.
Oh, yeah. Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, kind of badly.
Badly, I know it. I know it well.
So I thought, because that's a very cheesy music video, and I thought that was, I wish they would have created their own, you know, finale for that. So I thought that was a little weak. But that song has meaning. And way, like Steve said, that everything is commentary on each other, I think works. So, it's an up-and-down movie for me, but ultimately I was very much won over by it.
I loved it. And you guys have to understand that when I was a kid, Elton John was my hero. Adored Elton John. He was my first, really favorite musician and songwriter. And throughout the 70s, there was, for my money, there was like nobody better on the planet. So I was a joy during this entire movie. And he is unbelievable in this movie, Taron Egerton. He's unbelievable. Not only is it a great performance, but man, he can sing. And I totally now forgive him for the Kingsman movies. completely. Jamie Bell is
in which
fantastic.
He rescued Elton John.
Yeah. Yeah. But Jamie Bell is fantastic, and they really, really were very, very smart in emphasizing how important the relationship between Elton John and Bernie Taupin was, and how what a major part of his success that was. And I loved all the musical numbers. I thought it was really bright and joyous. I thought all the performances were good. I really thought Bryce Dallas Howard was an interesting choice to play the role, but she's really good in it. And I was moved by it. There were moments in the movie, because I love his music so much. And this movie takes place in the wheelhouse when he was great. You know what I mean? Like, this is the best material, the time period, the best material that he ever did. And there were times in the movie when they were performing the songs or doing musical numbers when I teared up because I loved the music so much and I was so emotionally invested in this story. Now, granted, you know, we've seen stories where, you know, talented musician, self-destructive, does drugs, drinks a lot, has to go to rehab. We've seen that. That's a cliche in and of itself. But the way they handled it in this movie, not only do they tap into the emotion of it, not only the accuracy of being an addict, but they do it in such a beautiful way. And I'm going to say this, and you guys are both going to get it. It reminded me a lot, in terms of style, of Across the Universe. And I know you guys hate that movie. Everybody hates it but me. I love that movie, and it reminded me of Across the Universe, and I mean that as a compliment.
And now I hate Rocketman.
You've tainted this movie for me.
Yeah. I'm sorry, man. It did. It totally reminded me of Across the Universe.
And many pay more taint on it.
Many, many spots, but... No, this is top-notch all the way across. It's beautifully imaginative. It's beautifully directed. Obviously, the music is fantastic. And I loved it. And I didn't mind. I think it was right to close with I'm Still Standing, because that was like that was when he came out and said, "Hey, look, I had some issues and now I'm good. I'm standing. I'm going to continue." And I think it's perfect that they ended that way.
I just think the music video homage was a little weird.
Okay. Although, go ahead.
You're right, Eric, except that in the context of this film, suddenly that music video doesn't seem so outrageous.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Feels like part of the movie. Outrageous. It's just cheesy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but I do want to mention one thing. One thing that disappointed me. I think this is one of the best movies of the year, and I loved every second of it. I kind of missed that they didn't do Someone Save My Life Tonight. I think that's one of his best and most important songs, you know, and most personal stuff between him and Bernie. And they got the suicide attempt in the movie, but they don't have the song. And that was the one thing that I was like, man, you know, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
They got Don't Go Breaking My Heart in there.
They did. An actress playing Kiki D. That was awesome.
I laughed out loud in the theater. I'm just like, yeah, all right.
Well, that's my dad's favorite Elton John song. So when they stood, because we saw it. And when it started, when they started singing, he's like, oh, I love this song. So, all right. I'm highly recommending Rocketman. I know Steve is too. And Eric, you're kind of on the fence, but you're recommending it.
No, I'm not even on the fence. I'm recommending it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Hang on, guys. We have a little movie about a lizard to talk about right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. It's Monday. My dad's going to tell a joke, and we've got the movie reviews to continue. One more movie to talk about. Steve Procopi is a new addition to the show. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so I do have to say this, that the two movies that I saw on Saturday were both... both subjects that were a major part of my childhood, this next one was also a major part of my childhood. We already covered Elton John, and now we're going to cover Godzilla King of the Monsters. Eric, tell us about it.
Okay, well, this is actually a direct sequel to Gareth Edwards' sort of 2014 reboot of Godzilla. Although this one, although many of the characters, supporting characters who appeared in that movie, also make appearances or cameo appearances in this film, there's a new set of protagonists. In the human world, at least. In an opening that, well, all I can say is reminiscent of Batman versus Superman, where we get sort of a different perspective of the carnage that took place at the end of the 2014 film. We see the husband and wife of Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga, two scientists who were there in the middle of all this carnage, and actually lose their youngest son as a result of it. They still have a daughter, who's played by Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things. And fast forward several years later to present time, and Godzilla has disappeared. But there are other sightings of other creatures or titans around the world that are frozen or about to be unfrozen. Vera Farmiga has developed this sonar thing that allows them to potentially talk to the Titans, communicate in some way to basically say, don't crush us. Kyle Chandler, the two of them are estranged now, and he wants nothing to do with this, but he's called back into action when people realize that the sonar thing might be happening and some of these other creatures may be unleashed. And surprise, surprise, they all are eventually. Many of the creatures that Godzilla nerds will have a lot of fondness for, like Mothra and Rodan, amongst others. It's all leading to a lot of carnage and a lot of humans talking to each other in bunkers, trying to figure out how to stop them. And that goes on for the extent of over 2 hours. But unlike the 2014 film, which I kind of liked, I didn't think it was great, but when it did finally get down to going full Godzilla on us, I really enjoyed it. Not so much with the human characters, and it seems that they've tripled down on the human characters in this film. There's a lot of them in bunkers and looking at military screens, communicating with one another, trying to figure out how to contain what eventually could be, end up being the destruction of all living things if these creatures, don't stop fighting each other and wiping things out. There's some twists and turns to the human characters, one dumber than the next. Even by dumb monster movie standards, the behavior of some of the characters that are supposed to be smart with big ideas are stupid beyond belief. But even dumber than that is that I couldn't believe how exceptionally bored I was watching this film. This is a movie that unleashes this one monster, and there's a thing in the fight, and then there's another monster unleashed, and there's a thing, and there's a fight. The whole point of this movie, I thought, was we were going to finally get some real monster-on-monster action, like we got a bit of at the end of the 2014 film, and you have to wait so long for these creatures to get together with one another. And even then, it's immensely dissatisfying, primarily because the visual effects artists and the people who made these movies, for some reason, just want to set everything at night, set it during inclement weather. I was reminded of watching Pacific Rim all again, which is a movie inspired by all these films. I'm not saying Pacific Rim Uprising was good in any stretch, but at least it was set at daylight. I gotta say, man, I think Rampage is a better film than Godzilla King of the Monsters, because again, at least it takes place in daylight, in broad daylight. You can see the carnage that's going on around him, and there's a sense of real goofy fun about it. This movie actually kind of takes itself way too seriously to have any sense of fun with. And I had zero fun with this movie, with the exception of, you know, waiting for Ken Watanabe to, you know, speak his next line. Every character in this movie is an idiot. Kyle Chandler is horrible in it. His entire performance looks like he's just 1 minute away from having to go to the bathroom in every scene. And Vera Farmiga's character and her motivation is so idiotic that I when she says the line in the movie, "We're doing this for Andrew," I was just like, "You got another kid, idiot!" That's all. I wanted to scream that at the screen. But I'm like, okay, if you're just going to give me some monster and monster action, I'll wait for it. And I waited, and I waited, and I waited. And then, it's at night, and it's at inclement weather, and it's dark and murky, and you can't see anything, and it's boring on top of it. I think this is a terrible film.
Wow. All right, Steve?
I do not think it's a terrible film. As unfair as it might seem, this film is really out to get, like, the Godzilla geek crowd. Like, this is, like, the one that's sort of built for, like, the decades-long fans, which isn't, like I said, isn't entirely fair to people that aren't obsessed with Godzilla movies. But I will say that dumb human characters is nothing new in Godzilla movies. And too many human characters and too much talking is not new to Godzilla movies. And I'm not saying that makes it any better. I'm just saying I kind of went in expecting that, especially when you look at the cast list. And, I'm always sort of impressed by how many really cool actors they get in these more recent films. But if they're not, and they got to give them something to do or they're not going to show up. And, yeah, they're way overwritten. And there's just, like, we don't care as much about what's going on with the humans. I barely remember what the intricacies. I did kind of dig the idea that there's this, I don't think Eric mentioned, there's like a sort of an eco-terrorist group running around in this.
Yeah.
That thinks that letting all of the Titans free will be good for the Earth because it's going to kind of reset the Earth, not destroy all humans, although that's certainly a possibility that they really don't seem to be considering enough, but they just want to sort of pare down. It's like basically the Thanos effect. They just want to pare down the population by a significant amount and just start from scratch and hopefully work together with the monsters, which doesn't seem likely, but at least they think that's going to work. But I dig the idea that at least that was sort of a part of it. That was, like, just ridiculous enough to be fun. But, yeah, I mean, just having these particular monsters, Ghidorah and Mothra and Rodan, that's basically the cast list of the Ghidorah three-headed monster film from 64. And I thought that was really great. It delivered on that one thing that I really wanted to see, and it was sort of hinted at the end of Kong Skull Island, that there are all these monsters out there. And we should mention, this is also, it's not a sequel to Kong, but it is in the same universe. Kong is mentioned, although never seen, which kind of bummed me out a little bit. I thought we might get a little tease of him here, since this film is setting up the Godzilla versus Kong movie next year. But they're, I guess they're just saving him for that. But yeah, I mean, the nighttime stuff, I mean, I just sort of grown to expect that from these movies, and it's a little bit annoying. It was more annoying to me in the 2014 version. Here, at least they try to explain it by saying that the monsters are so huge and so powerful that they're disrupting the atmosphere and they're causing these weather issues everywhere. They're bringing it with them to a certain degree, which again, it's really just a cheap way that they can sort of skimp on the special effects. But
that's right.
Say the epic quality of these fonts, I think the design quality of the monsters is great. I think that the fight sequences are giant and big, and like they don't spare, like the entire city of Boston is leveled in the course of this film, which is going to make a lot of people very happy, I think. But yeah, I don't think, as much as I would have liked to have seen it, big and bright and colorful, It just seems like more horrific to have it be darker and there's lightning and there's just fire and whatever else they're spewing, like nuclear whatever they're spewing out of their bodies. I very rarely give a pass to films that I think aren't quite living up to certain expectations, but like Godzilla movies, there's so many of them. At this point, you kind of have to
we have certain expectations for them, and this, I think, beat the expectations that I had, certainly. I mean, yeah, like I said, too many characters, very for such a simple story, but no, I was fully entertained by this thing.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on. I'll tell you what I thought of it when we come back. And we're talking about the Godzilla movie. And then Eric will stick around and we'll do a quick box office rundown for you, too. All right, that's all coming up right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in, tell a joke, because it's Monday morning, and it's also Monday morning, which means we got to wrap up the Monday morning movie reviews. Here is Steve Procopi. Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so I love this movie. Here's the thing, and what you said is absolutely right on the money. This movie is specifically made for Godzilla nerds. That's it. And I happen to be a Godzilla nerd, and I had a great time with this movie. There are tons of Easter eggs in it for people who are nerdy like I am when it comes to Godzilla movies. The choice of the monsters that they have in this movie. I had no idea Rodan was in it. When Rodan showed up, I was like, yeah, you know, and Rodan, of course, turns out to be the jerk that he always is, because Rodan is the biggest jerk of the Titans in the Godzilla franchise.
Mm-hmm.
The human interaction. I mean, I thought Bradley Whitford was funny. Millie Bobby Brown just basically screams and cries throughout the entire movie. The motivation, especially by Vera Farmiga's character, is really stupid. But I don't care about that. What I want to see is buildings being destroyed. I want to see giant monsters fighting each other, stepping on people. And there's a lot of that. And it's quality stuff. And it's classic Godzilla characters made by filmmakers that clearly know these movies and love these movies and are giving a gift to the dorks like me. Now, I don't know if the hardcore, you know, people who aren't hardcore Godzilla fans, I don't know how they're going to react to this movie. They probably won't like it nearly as much as I did, because I'm the target audience. I am absolutely, completely the target audience for this movie. And I ate it up, man. I saw it in IMAX. It was big. It was loud. There's a lot of destruction. Godzilla was cool, and Ghidorah looked fantastic. I loved the whole the head growing back moment, which is one of my favorite moments in the movie. And again, I don't care about the human stuff. Whatever's happening, I just want to see destruction, and there's plenty of it in this movie. And I'm really looking forward to Godzilla versus King Kong. I'm really looking forward to it. And they even set up another one at the very postscript. Movie that they're going to do a little bit later on, and I stayed for the postscript because I thought I was going to get to see Kong, but I didn't. But they set something else up, which was really unexpected. So you do get a little picture of Kong, though, during the last credits. You get a little picture of him.
Yes.
That's the only thing that you get.
Yeah.
But no, I'm the target audience. I loved it. I ate it up, and I think Godzilla fans, Godzilla dorks, like my producer Tom. Tom is a fully admitted Godzilla dork. On Friday morning during the show, we both wore Godzilla shirts to work. That's how.
Nothing wrong with it.
So there you go. All right. What's next week? We got the Secret Life of Animals or whatever the hell that.
Secret Life of Pets 2,
yep.
And Dark Phoenix.
Oh, Dark Phoenix, another X-Men movie.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Perhaps the last.
It's more Game of Thrones actors.
Yeah, with more Game of Thrones actors. They're getting work all over the place. Steve, we'll talk to you next week. And again, thank you for coming in and welcome, buddy.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely.
Having me back next week. That'd be awesome. Thanks, guys. I'm glad I passed the audition.
All right, buddy. Take care. Steve Procopi did a great job for his first night, for his first morning. All right, let's get some box office real quick. Now, Godzilla was number one, but
yeah.
it made 40. What did it make? 49 million.
Now
that's disappointing, right?
It's very much so. especially the early estimates. You know, everyone, you know, writes stories now on Friday, like sort of like midday, like where the sort of the numbers are progressing very early on. And Godzilla, the numbers it was putting up very early on Friday were very positive. It had a very good Thursday night, so the numbers are actually being projected in sort of the low 60s, which is still far down from what Godzilla made in 2014. That made $93 million opening weekend.
No, it did?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it barely crossed over to 200. So the word of mouth was not great on that one, but I think it might actually be even worse on this one.
Wow.
$49 million. I mean, now they have to start looking very heavily at, you know, how much they're going to be spending on Godzilla versus Kong.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to get that postscript movie that you saw.
Yeah, that's maybe it's true. Yeah, you're right. Wow, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
Aladdin chugging along, making more money than I ever thought it would.
Yeah, Guy Ritchie's out of jail again.
Yeah, that's too bad. $185 million in both. I really thought that this wasn't going to do nearly as good as it's doing.
No, it held remarkably well in the second weekend. So, yeah, it's you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Number three, Rocket Man, $25 million. Is that about where they thought?
Yeah, that's probably exactly what I thought it was going to do. And, you know, I think word of mouth will probably be pretty good on it.
Yeah.
Whether it makes it or not, I don't know. But it's a good start.
Yeah. And then Ma, $18.2 million, and probably didn't cost anything, right, Blumhouse?
$5 million it cost.
Oh, man, wow.
Yeah. It's already in profit.
There you go. Number five, John Wick, Chapter 3, $11 million, bringing his total up to $125.7 million.
Yeah, it's going to be one of Lionsgate's biggest hits.
Number six, Booksmart, with $8.6 million. Let's see, Pikachu, the little detective Pikachu dude, $130 million that movie's made.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
But what about Brightburn? That's a disaster, right?
Brightburn dropped 70% in its second weekend.
And nobody went to see it in its first weekend, really.
Barely, yeah.
Wow. And then The Hustle rounds out the top ten, $33 million. That's all it's made.
Yeah.
Wow. So what are we looking at? The Secret Life of Pets Part 2 will be number one?
Easily.
Yeah.
That's going to be an easy number one next weekend.
Dark Phoenix, yeah.
And I think Godzilla's going to drop pretty heavily.
Yeah, I think you're right. So there you go. All right, well, that's what we're looking forward to next week. Godzilla underperformed, and so now we're looking at the Secret Life of... now, that first one made a lot of money, right? The Secret Life of Pets?
Oh, yeah. Over 360
million. $360 million. Wow. Okay. All right. Well, cool, man. Hey, thanks a lot, and we will talk to you next week, Eric. Okay. See you later. There you go, Eric. Eric Childress, everybody. So there you go. That's the box office. Those are the movie reviews, and we're going to take a quick break here on 720 WGN.